Welcome to the Beacon Broadcast from Beacon Baptist Church in Burlington, North Carolina, featuring expositional Bible teaching by Pastor Greg Barkman. If you'd like to correspond with the Beacon Broadcast, or if you wish to support this radio ministry, write to the Beacon Broadcast, Post Office Box 159, Alamance, North Carolina, 27201, or find us on the web at beaconbaptist.com. BeaconBaptist.com. The Beacon Broadcast is supported in part by the gifts of faithful listeners. Now, with today's message from God's Word, here is Greg Barkman.
Well, today we move out of John chapter 7 and into chapter 8. And take up what I think is one of the most interesting and arresting accounts in the Gospel of John, if not in the entire New Testament. And I'm talking about the woman taken in adultery. It is certainly one of the best known accounts, and it shows us the attitude of Christ toward this sinful woman, his saving mercy, his wonderful love, balanced perfectly against the backdrop of God's holiness. It is a very instructive account of this poor sinner who finds mercy from the Lord Jesus Christ. I probably need to tell you, however, that it is also a controversial account because some have questioned its authenticity. It is not found in all of the manuscripts, and some have therefore concluded that it probably is not authentic. However, most Bible scholars, most conservative Bible scholars, conclude that it is authentic. It belongs in our Bible. It may not have been placed at this juncture where we find it in John chapter 8 in all of the accounts, but nevertheless, it is a real and a genuine account. Not only is this account found in hundreds of the Greek manuscripts, but Augustine, the great theologian of the 4th century, stated that many copyists had omitted this portion because of concern that its inclusion would encourage adultery, and that may explain why it is sometimes absent. So, we'll continue this introduction into the account and then get into the account itself on this Sunday, June 7. We're glad that you could join us. We're grateful for those whose financial gifts enable us to do this. Well, at any rate, the absence of this passage from some of the oldest manuscripts may have another explanation. Rather than this section being a later addition inserted into many of the later manuscripts, it may in fact be a genuine account removed from many of the older manuscripts for well-meaning but badly misplaced reasons related to godly living. It does seem to go easy on this adulterous woman, and that offends some people, particularly those who have a Pharisaic spirit, a self-righteous spirit, a legalistic spirit, and that may very well account for the fact that it is not found in some manuscripts. It may actually have been shamefully removed by well-meaning people, but nevertheless, who should not have been tampering with the Bible. I myself am strongly inclined to believe that this is a genuine account, an inspired account, an authentic recount. In the first place, I'm reluctant to remove a significant portion from the Bible as it has come down to us today. I do believe in biblical preservation as well as verbal inspiration. But furthermore, I find nothing in this passage that is out of character with our Lord, or what we know about the Pharisees, or what we learn in the other writings of John. I don't see any reason as I study it, to conclude that it could be anything but genuine. It is not at all like other obviously erroneous accounts I have read, inserted into some manuscripts at various times, but scream their false nature at first reading. This one, in contrast to those, strikes me as authentic. I know that's very subjective, but I'm telling you what I have concluded as I have wrestled with this question myself. But furthermore, the internal evidence of the book of John itself seems to me to be compelling. Try to read the text without it and see how it reads. Go from chapter 7, verse 53, and skip down to chapter 8, verse 12. And it doesn't flow smoothly. At least it doesn't in my mind. Read it again with this count intact, and it all fits together smoothly and sensibly. And so, for this and other reasons, I am happy to add my endorsement to its authenticity, and I will move forward examining it with the full confidence that it is part of the inspired and preserved Word of the living God. Well, what do we have? Let's look, first of all, at the scene, and we'll take it piece by piece. Verse 1. But Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Now early in the morning he came again into the temple, and all the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. Remember, from chapter 7, the time is the Feast of Tabernacles. Christ's Water of Life discourse was delivered in chapter 7. And this account tells us that the day after, early in the morning, Christ came to the temple of Jerusalem again, and the people were there. They wanted to be taught by him. They were waiting for him to come. It makes perfect sense. It flows. It flows linguistically. It flows in narrative sequence as we move right into this account. So here's Christ in the temple, once again, possibly in the court of the women, and Jesus is teaching the multitudes. All the people of the previous day. Here's another use of the word all, and I have to point these out as I come along. We read now, early in the morning, he came again to the temple, and all the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. Well, what does this all mean? Clearly, it doesn't mean all the people of the world. It does say all, A-L-L, all the people came to him, but it doesn't mean, obviously, all the people of the world. It clearly does not mean all the people of Israel. It clearly does not mean all the people who lived in Jerusalem. And so, once again, what we find is a restricted use of the word all. And I would submit to you that if you will study the word all, which is a very frequently used word, but study the word all in its context and notice what it means in every context, you will find that nearly, not necessarily all, but nearly all of the uses, and there I'm using the word all of the uses of the word all are actually used in a restricted sense, that is, in the sense of all of a certain class, all of a certain category. Not all without exception, but all of a certain group. And in this case, it would seem to be all of the people who listened, who gathered to him on the previous day. That's what goes with the flow. Now, early in the morning, he came again into the temple, and all the people came to him and sat down. He sat down and taught them. It could also mean all of the people who were present at the time when Jesus came to the temple. That he came into the temple and everybody there, whatever they were doing, stopped what they were doing and came and listened to him. They wanted to hear Jesus. All of the people who were there, all of the kinds of people who were there, the multitude that was mentioned in the previous chapter and so forth. And here's Christ, therefore, teaching once again, calmly dispensing life-giving instruction for all who have an interest in it, which seemed to be virtually everybody who was present in the temple on that day. That's the scene that is set before us. But now we come to the scandal, which starts with the grand interruption of verse 3. Then the scribes and Pharisees brought to him a woman caught in adultery. And when they had set her in the midst, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman was caught in adultery in the very act. Now Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned, but what do you say?" This they said, testing him, that they might have something of which to accuse him. But Jesus stooped down and wrote on the ground with his finger, as though he did not hear them. So when they continued asking him, he raised himself up and said to them, "He who is without sin among you, let him throw a stone at her first." And again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. Then those who heard it, being convicted by their conscience, went out, one by one, beginning with the oldest, even to the last, and Jesus was left alone, and the woman standing in the midst. Well, here we have an interruption of Christ's teaching. Here come the scribes and the Pharisees. We read in verse 3, "Then the scribes and Pharisees brought to him a woman caught in adultery, and when they had set her in the midst." They came in the middle of Christ's teaching. They were not evidently included in that word "all" in verse 2, "and all the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them." But they were informed that he had come back and was teaching again, and of course this displeased them greatly, and they were determined to arrest him. It was already clear from the previous chapter. And so they thought this would be a great opportunity to carry out their plan. And so here they come, bringing this woman who had been taken in adultery, bringing her into the place where Jesus was teaching, interrupting his sermon, setting her down right in the midst, in front of Jesus and in the midst of this whole crowd, a large multitude of people, no consideration, concern, sensitivity whatsoever for the feelings of this woman. But they bring her to Jesus, and the question is, why are they bringing her to Jesus? Are they thereby ascribing to him the authority to decide such matters? I don't think that's what they intended to communicate. They had other motives behind what they were doing, and they were not honorable motives, for sure, and they were certainly not there to honor Christ and to communicate to the crowd that had gathered around him that they considered him to be an authority on such matters. Far from it. That's not what they were doing. They had something else in mind, but here they brought the woman to Jesus. Again, why to him? Well, obviously, because they had an agenda. There was no other reason to bring her to him. If they had a woman who needed to be dealt with according to the law, then they should have brought her to the Sanhedrin. They should have brought her to the synagogue of which she was a member and let the synagogue deal with her. But they have something nefarious in mind, and so they bring her to Jesus, who really doesn't have any recognized authority by the religious leaders. That's for sure. A question, of course, that arises in my mind, and I think in the minds of many people, is where was the man? It takes two to commit adultery. If they caught her, as they say, in the very act, then obviously her partner in immorality had to be present as well, and it's pretty hard to explain how he could not have been apprehended as easily as she was, but they don't bring him. Is this evidence of a double standard? It would seem so to me. But at any rate, the interruption is made, and here's the startling announcement, as described in verse 4. Then they said to him, "Teacher, this woman was caught in adultery in the very act." A woman found guilty of adultery. No question about it. They're not dealing with someone else accusing her and they're trying to find out the truth. No, this woman evidently was caught in the very act of adultery. That in itself, of course, conjures up all kinds of shameful images and pictures, but she was caught in the act of adultery. And here she is with her guilty offense against the law of Moses. She has violated the law, and here she is to be dealt with. How did they manage such a dramatic act unless it was contrived? That, again, no one knows. But it seems pretty suspicious, doesn't it? It's pretty fishy. How in the world did they manage to collect this offender, this specimen of one who has broken the law, in such a fashion? Caught in the very act, we're told. But there is no evident concern for the law of God, no true concern for the sin of adultery, certainly no concern for the well-being of this woman or her partner, or, as I say, they would have brought them both. The law to which they're referring, the law of Moses, had prescribed penalties not just for the woman who was caught in adultery, but for the man as well. Where is he? But they bring this woman and they announce her guilt, and then they pose this, they make a statement and pose this question. Now Moses, verse 5, "Now Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned. But what do you say?" They're trying to work him. They're trying to trap him, no question about it. All right, here's what Moses says, "But what do you say?" Christ had, of course, on some occasions, presumed to expound upon, to enlarge upon, to explain, and we might even be tempted to say improve the law of Moses, certainly to improve upon the traditional interpretations of the law of Moses that have been passed down by the fathers. And they knew that. They knew what he taught in the Sermon on the Mount about the law of Moses. "You have heard that it hath been said, but I say unto you," and so forth. And so, since he had taken upon himself this prerogative of addressing the law of Moses in such authoritative terms and even expounding upon it and adding to it in some ways, certainly, "You have heard that it hath been said, you shall not commit adultery, but I say unto you, whoever looks upon a woman for the purpose of lusting after her has committed adultery already in his heart." There Jesus deals with the man, not with the woman. And he says, adultery is not just the actual physical act of adultery, but as far as God's concerned, who sees the heart, the desire to involve yourself in adultery. The viewing of something or someone for the purpose of feeding such inordinate desires, such immoral desires, such unlawful desires, maybe is the right terminology to use, is in the mind of God the same as committing adultery. Now, obviously, it doesn't have the same impact upon the life of another. When you commit adultery, actually commit it with an adulterous partner, you not only sin yourself before God and His law, but you also involve someone else in your sin. And that adds to your guilt. You've not only made yourself guilty before God, but you've contributed to the guilt of another in some way or form. You say, well, I wasn't the one who instigated it. The other person did, but you agreed. That other person could not have committed adultery with you unless you agreed to commit adultery with them, with him or her. So you've involved another person. That certainly adds to the weightiness of the situation, the magnitude of the guilt that is involved. And of course, furthermore, adultery is involving yourself in a sexual relationship with someone who is not your spouse. So when you actually commit adultery, you have truly sinned against your husband or your wife, your marriage partner. And you have harmed them most seriously. So it is true, what I'm saying is, it is true that the actual act or commission of adultery has ramifications which are far greater than simply the thought when you only feast upon an adulterous liaison in your mind, whether it be with a living person that you know or with an imaginary person that has been conjured up. When you do that, you're not involving another guilty person. You're not, at least to the same extent, betraying your spouse, although I think even in that mental extent you are to some degree. These are not easy matters to figure out, but I don't want to dismiss that entirely. But what I'm saying is, Jesus added to the Mosaic law against adultery, the seventh commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery. Jesus added to that by saying, in the sight of God, your mental commission of adultery is adultery. It may not be adultery to your spouse who doesn't know about it, and there's nothing really that took place. There's not another person involved. It may not be adultery in that you've involved another person. There's nobody else that you have dragged into guilt before God and dragged them into breaking the law of God. But God, who knows the heart, says you have just committed adultery. That makes the viewing of pornography, as well as other things, but just that one thing in itself, which has gotten so common in our day, that makes that a very serious sin. Too many people pass that off as if that's nothing. It's not I haven't done anything. It isn't a sin. I haven't involved myself with another person. I haven't betrayed my spouse by joining myself sexually to someone outside of my marriage. But you can't get around the plain words of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. Whoever looks upon a woman for the purpose of lusting after her has committed adultery already in his heart. How are you going to get around that? How can you explain the viewing of pornography in any other way except a violation of that teaching of Jesus? I don't see how you can avoid that at all. It is a serious sin. It needs to be rooted out. God's people need to put that out of their lives. God's people need to close the door on that. And if you have been involved in that for an extended period of time, it is a strong habit that is going to take some work and help by the grace of God to break. It's an addiction. In some ways, like alcohol or drugs or tobacco, it's an addiction. It's going to have to be broken. And it won't be easily broken, but it must be broken. It's wrong. But undoubtedly, the Pharisees knew about Christ's boldness in taking up the law of Moses and expanding upon it and teaching about it in an authoritative way like this. And so they think it's fair game to bring this woman and say, now, Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned, but what do you say? What do you say about the law forbidding adultery, and particularly, and here's where they were trying to trap him, by the penalty of stoning? Moses, in the law, not just said, you shall not commit adultery, commandment number 7 in the Decalogue, but Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned. But what do you say? This is particularly troublesome and difficult because, as they very well knew, and as everybody knew, the Romans had removed from them the right to carry out capital punishment. They couldn't do that legally. But Moses said that ought to be the penalty. That was the penalty, not ought to be. That was the penalty. Moses and the law commanded us that such should be stoned. Pretty serious penalty in the law of Moses for adulterous activity. So, what do you say? That's what Moses said. What do you say? And they obviously were trying to find some way to trap him, to reduce his authority and his honorable reputation among the people who loved to hear him. They wanted to diminish his influence. They were concerned about it. They were jealous because of it. They were particularly troubled when the guards that they had sent out to arrest him the day before came back and were apparently enthralled with his teaching, mesmerized by it, were entranced by it, were unable to arrest him because of it. Nobody ever spoke like he did. Well, that just angered them all the more. We've got to do something. Not only, they were determined, of course, to kill him, but not only to kill him, but we really need to make him look bad in the eyes of the people before we do that, because this thing is really getting out of hand. He's capturing the loyalty, the admiration, the honor of the people. So, what are you going to do? Are you going to contradict Moses and say, well, Moses said that, but I say don't do that? Moses said stone her, but I say don't stone her. Is that what he's going to do? That would really set him up for losing some of the honor that was given to him by the people. Some of them would be very disappointed that he would contradict Moses in such a way. But if on the other hand, he said, Moses said, stoner, stoner, then they could accuse him before the Roman authorities. This man told us to stone this woman in violation of Roman law. What are you Romans going to do about that? Oh, they were trying to trap him. And they thought they were going to succeed in this occasion like they had on some other occasions, but were not able to do so. And we'll have to come back to it again, Lord willing, next Sunday and take it up and examine what happened and how Jesus once again showed himself to be so much wiser than they. Until next week, Greg Barkman saying good day. May God give you his eternal peace.